the priority right now for me is my family, and I want to make sure they are safe.
As the Israel-Hamas war rages on, we turn to the families of victims on both sides, seeking a way to preserve their safety. What is the path forward? We have expert analysis. On the home front, mass casualties in Maine. Another crazed shooter takes out his anger on unsuspecting people. We talk to a Catholic priest from the community.
There are definitely tears, but there's also a lot of smiles. I really, in knowing, you know, that your baby is here.
And honoring the babies never met. A unique ministry for families who have lost unborn children to miscarriage. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
It's very Holocaust reminiscent to have people come into your home and kill you for being Jewish.
We're mourning for every child who's killed. We're mourning for every mother who's actually looking for her child under the rubble.
Humans suffering from all sides, regardless of personal politics. The impact of war on innocent people caught in the crossfire rages on in Israel and Gaza. The horrors of war continue into this week. The conflict erupted after Hamas terrorists attacked, murdered, and captured innocent Israeli citizens in an incursion over the Gaza border on October 7th. That attack shocked the world. But the Israeli airstrikes in response have drawn an equally passionate response. Late this week, European Union leaders called for a humanitarian pause in the fighting to allow time for aid to get into Gaza residents. As destructive as the Israeli airstrikes in Gaza have been in the first 2 weeks of the war, it grew more intense this week. Neighborhoods leveled, civilians left homeless. Israel says the bombing campaign is focused on destroying Hamas military infrastructure, which is often built near homes and hospitals. The Gaza Health Ministry, controlled by Hamas, claims more than 6,500 people have died. Desperate residents rush those with a chance of life to exhausted doctors, and everyone on the street is left to dodge incoming. While the bombs continued to fall, first aid shipments began to trickle in. The truck shipments were welcome, but aid workers say the humanitarian crisis is so overwhelming, the supplies pale in comparison to what is needed. One-third of the hospitals in Gaza are now closed, the others near collapse, as fuel or power runs out and medical supplies dwindle. Fuel shipments are not part of the aid deliveries. The Israeli military says Hamas stole large amounts of fuel from the United Nations Relief Agency, is now hoarding it, and if the hospitals need fuel, they should first ask Hamas to resupply them. As the chaos of war plays out on the streets of Gaza, it's believed at least 220 hostages kidnapped from Israel are still being held, many below the streets in a network of Hamas tunnels. Early in the week, Hamas did release two elderly Israeli women, one of whom described her capture.
My mom is telling the horrific stories. They walked for a few kilometers on the wet ground. There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
Israeli troops and rows of tanks remain posted along the border, ready to begin the ground war into Gaza to root out Hamas. There have been a few tank raids with quick withdrawals, but it appears the main advance may be delayed as negotiators buy time to get in more humanitarian aid and try to broker the release of hostages, more than a dozen of whom are Americans. Many hostage relatives are scared and frustrated, worried more pressure must be exerted before time runs out.
There are over 200 hostages being held in Gaza right now. Over 100 of them are from 33 countries. Where is the world? We, the families of the 200 hostages, are far away on our own planet of agony. But where are you?
Families on both sides of the divide, Israelis and Palestinians, plead for the safety and well-being of their loved ones. News in Depth reporter Mark Iron spoke to several relatives of war victims and others who themselves are living on the edge of conflict.
Since early October, reports of thousands of lives lost, both in Israel.
It's a situation that we have never dealt with it before.
And in Gaza.
Innocent people are killed.
The violence began on October 7th with a terrorist attack carried out by Hamas, leaving a scene of bloody carnage in southern Israel.
Nobody ever imagined that this can happen like that. So.
Itai Eluz teaches at an architecture college. He lives with his wife and two young daughters in Israel, about 30 miles from the border with Gaza. Initially, he found out one of his students had been murdered.
That was the first shock that I had with somebody who was really, really close to me for the last 2 years. And we didn't have even the time to understand what happened with him. And you know, the names start coming up.
Names of the dead, and the list would continue to grow.
I know many of people.
Just this week, the brother of his wife's best friend, who had been missing, was confirmed dead. His body found nearly 2 weeks after the Hamas attack.
I think all of Israel right now are feeling is shock.
Meanwhile, innocent Palestinian lives have also been lost in the Israeli airstrikes.
My aunt was killed in the bombing of the church in Gaza.
Shireen Awad, her mother, and another woman spoke with us outside Bethlehem in the West Bank. About 50 miles away in Gaza, they all had family members who were killed this month inside a Christian place of worship.
Most of the people that are actually affected are the innocent people who want to live.
Their family members were seeking shelter from Israeli air raids in a historic Greek Orthodox church, but it was hit.
Everybody asked them to go to the church as a shelter to avoid this bombing. And unfortunately, they bombed the church.
They say there is no safe place in Gaza. In parts of Israel earlier this month, no place was safe from the Hamas attack.
The way we lost him is going to haunt our family for the rest of our lives.
From Washington, D.C., Layla Levy remembers her first cousin, Dr. Daniel Levy Ludmir, who was killed by terrorists as he tried to save the lives of others inside an Israeli medical clinic.
In this point in my grief, to be honest with you, I am happy because I know he would have wanted his wife and kids to live. And they did.
Levy left behind a wife and two children.
Not only did they lose a great dad, a fantastic husband, Lehi is his wife's name. Lehi lost her soulmate.
As for Layla Levy, she doesn't want to see any more innocent people killed.
Innocent people are being murdered on a daily basis.
Mohammed Arafat grew up in Gaza and spent more than 20 years there before moving to America to make a living and provide for his family back home.
I call him from 10 to 20 times a day.
Mohammed worries about his mother, father, siblings, and nieces and nephews in Gaza who evacuated their home just one day before it took on significant damage. He says an Israeli strike destroyed nearby homes and killed these children living in the neighborhood. Seeking relief from air raids in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, his family fled south, along with many other Palestinians, to cram into whatever living spaces were available. They found an open room to stay in with more than 15 people.
There is no privacy, and there is one bathroom to share, and there is literally no water in that house.
The situation unsustainable, so the family moved back to the north with a relative. To conserve electricity, they turn on a generator for about an hour a day to charge phones or radios. They lack access to basic needs.
There is nothing open to buy food or to buy, you know, water or bread. It's a disaster. And that's the humanitarian situation that a lot of people don't know about.
Itai Eluz says Israelis have been shaken by the recent violence inflicted upon them. He said although he always reassures his two young daughters, this is the first time as a father he hasn't felt confident in telling them not to worry.
That I can't really tell them, you know, 100% that everything is okay. No,
And as Shireen Awad and her mother mourn the loss of Palestinian family members in Gaza, they hope the God-given human rights of all will be respected.
We're all created in the image of God. We all deserve to be respected.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Though the Christian communities in both Israel and Gaza are very small, they do exist. Along with other innocent citizens caught in the crossfire of war, Christians are suffering grief and loss as well. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa, released this statement this week to those trapped in Gaza.
Do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. I am with you. Your suffering and pain are my concern, and I dedicate all my time in prayer, first of all, but also in dialogue with all the responsible in order to put an end to this situation as soon as possible and to support you as much as we can. You are not alone. All the Christian community in Holy Land, not only the land, all over the world is with you, praying for you and supporting you.
For analysis of the situation as it stands now in Israel, Palestine, and beyond, we're joined once again by Middle East expert Alberto Fernandez. He's the vice president of the Middle East Media Research Institute and a former ambassador and diplomat with the U.S. State Department. Alberto, welcome back. We're rolling into the fourth week of this conflict, and a ground offensive from Israel has not yet begun. What can we expect over the next few days?
Well, I think actually we're approaching, with this fourth week, an inflection point. And actually, I think that we are very close to, a much larger escalation in the fighting and perhaps that ground offensive. The sense is that we're reaching towards a certain point where something is going to happen. It's going to break one way or the other. So very soon we will see a ground offensive, maybe perhaps within hours, or we will see some kind of diplomatic pause of some sort.
Iran's role in this has been stressed by the U.S., and at the United Nations, Iran's foreign minister had this message for America and Western countries supporting Israel's airstrikes in Gaza. Let's take a listen.
We do not welcome to expansion of the war in the region, but I warn if the genocide in Gaza continues, they will not be spared from this fire. It is our home, and West Asia is our region.
Alberto, was this a threat to Americans on American soil?
Of course, it's a threat to Americans on American soil, but it's nothing new, nothing we haven't heard before. Since the Biden administration came into office in 2021, Iranian militias have fired rockets or attack drones at American bases almost 100 times, and very frequently in the last few days. So, I mean, he's hinting at something which is kind of already happening, but at a lower level.
It seems that all of the U.S. Military, as well as the president himself, have had one word for anyone who's trying to escalate this violence. They say don't, right? And at a press conference on Thursday, the Council of American Islamic Relations complained to the National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby about President Biden's refusal to use the Gaza Health Ministry's casualty numbers, calling him harsh. Kirby's response was uncharacteristically pointed. Let's listen to what he said.
It would be helpful if Hamas would let them leave their homes, leave areas, not shelter in tunnels underneath their houses and in hospitals, and let them get out of Gaza if they want to leave. We know that there are thousands waiting to leave Gaza writ large, and Hamas is preventing them from doing it. That is what is harsh.
Is misinformation driving some of these questions?
Certainly. I mean, people have political positions, and so people in wartime, especially, and we are in, full-scale war. Israel was attacked. Israel has declared war in return against Hamas. In wartime, there is disinformation and manipulation of the truth and completely false information put out. We're seeing a lot of that every day, especially from the very, very large kind of Palestinian leftist, Russian, China, Iranian nexus, which has a real presence on social media.
And the continued shelling in Gaza, the loss of civilian life there, it really has shaken much of the world, especially many Palestinian sympathizers in Arab countries. Jordan is a strong U.S. ally in the region, but the wife of King Abdullah recently made big news in an interview exclusive she gave to CNN. While acknowledging Israel's right to defend itself after the horrible attacks of October 7th, Queen Rania said the airstrikes have gone too far. Let's listen to her.
Even if Israel goes and defeats every last or kills every last Hamas member, then what? Haven't they left a trail of terrible memories, horrific memories, that will just create a new generation of resistance that is fiercer and more violent? Are we being told that it is wrong to kill a family, an entire family at gunpoint, but it's okay to shell them to death? I mean, there is a glaring double standard here, and it is just shocking to the Arab world.
Alberto, although her point is understood on the loss of life and the resentment, why have Jordan, Egypt, and the surrounding Arab countries refused to take in refugees to lower casualties?
Well, they have historically a lot of refugees. You know, Jordan is more than half Palestinian. In fact, Queen Rania herself is Palestinian. So, of course, she's channeling the Palestinian position perhaps more than the Jordanian one. I mean, it was, after all, her own father-in-law who shelled Palestinian refugee camps in 1970, Black September, when the Palestinians tried to overthrow the Kingdom of Jordan.
So in having her as the spokesperson for this, is there a reason that King Abdullah isn't coming out publicly saying some similar things?
Well, Jordan has to manage this reality, which is it has a very large, very vocal Palestinian population. The king himself is not Palestinian, and the military security services are not Palestinian. They're East Bankers. Or Hashemites, or not even from Jordan. So he has to kind of walk this fine line. Jordan is also strongly supported by the United States, strongly supported by the CIA and by the U.S. military. So there is an element in Jordan's foreign policy of saying one thing and doing something else.
Let's go a little deeper then into the Palestinian mentality. Many pro-Palestinian protests around the world and on college campuses in the U.S., like at George Washington University here in D.C., use the slogan or chant, "From the river to the sea." What does that mean to them?
Well, it means that there is one unitary Palestinian state to be held to exist in the Holy Land, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. So it is a call for the extermination of the state of Israel. What it's saying, that is Palestine, all of it. You may remember hearing some chants in New York right after the massacres on October 7th, where they said, you know, we want all of it. So often in the West, we think of a kind of a line and kind of divide pie and the, you know, settlements and all of that. But there's an element, a very powerful element, on the Palestinian side, that wants all of it for themselves. They want to rule the entire region. They want the elimination of the state of Israel. They don't want to share things with Israel. They want to conquer it and destroy it.
And is that a justification then for the violence from October 7th and the continued hostages that are being held?
Not at all. I mean, I think that the reality is that there have been repeated efforts to make peace. There have been repeated efforts to divide things, to offer, by the way, to offer the Palestinians almost everything that they asked for. Most recently in 2008, under the Olmert government, that offered even the Palestinians a capital in East Jerusalem, but it was turned down. Now, there's a difference even between, that was the PLO. Hamas believes that all of Palestine, all of 1948 Palestine, should be a one Islamic state.
Well, that's certainly what's fueling anti-Semitism here. Alberto, we will continue monitoring the situation and hope to have you back.
Thank you.
In other major news this week, the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. this year. Yet again, another lone gunman opening fire, this time in Lewiston, Maine. 18 people are confirmed dead and 13 are wounded, some critically. The shootings took place at a restaurant and a bowling alley where dozens of children and teens were gathered for youth night. Police began a massive manhunt on land and water for the suspect, a U.S. Army reservist who is a trained firearms instructor. Military officials say he was admitted to a mental health facility for 2 weeks this past July. At the time we record this program, the suspect is still on the loose, and police warn he is armed and dangerous. In response, schools, hospitals, and businesses in the Lewiston area went on lockdown, closed, or limited operations. Father Daniel Greenleaf, a priest at a Catholic church in Lewiston, celebrated Mass online for all those sheltering in place.
We practice our faith for the idea of when you say you practice being Catholic, for the times when you really need it. And this is going to be a time when we really need to lean on the faith and not forget all the things we said about God and about each other and about our faith during the good times. This is when we need to lean on them now.
Law enforcement officials say the suspect owned his weapons legally and that his family had warned authorities they were worried about his mental stability. Maine has the lowest violent crime rate in the nation, and last year, FBI statistics ranked it overall the safest state in the country. But with this senseless mass shooting, once again in America, innocent victims taken too soon. Our program will continue in a moment. The Synod on Synodality at the Vatican is in the final stretch, and Synod participants are taking advantage of these last few opportunities for prayer, discernment, and discussion. On Wednesday, delegates released a letter to the faithful all over the world, thanking them for their prayers and encouraging them to play an active role in the decision-making of the Church. Like many participants, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, head of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, emphasized the importance of listening.
We can draw from the richness of different traditions, and that's perhaps been one of the highlights of these past 3.5 weeks, the experience of the Church throughout the world and listening and exchanging with different exponents of that Church. If we do more listening, we might have a world that's a little more open to the other, a little more respectful of the dignity of the human person.
The delegates are also reviewing the final synthesis document, which summarizes the discussions that took place at the Synod. EWTN News contributor Catherine Hadro has been part of our special daily Synod coverage all week from our Vatican Bureau, and she joins us now to discuss this last full week of the Synod meetings. Catherine, welcome. Before we get into the Synod, the scandal of Slovenian priest and theologian Marko Rupnik, whose art is prominently featured at the Shrine to Our Lady of Lourdes in France, has erupted and caused even more heartbreak for victims of abuse. Tell us what happened.
Well, Monse, these are heinous allegations facing famed mosaic artist Father Marko Rupnik, former Jesuit. Heinous allegations involving sexual, spiritual, psychological abuse that the Jesuits found to be highly credible. That's why I say he's a former Jesuit, because the Jesuit order did an investigation into these allegations, found them to be highly credible. Father Rupnik was even excommunicated for a brief period before the Jesuit order ultimately kicked him out over disobedience. And this week, the news was that we learned that a diocese in Slovenia had accepted Rupnik back into active ministry. You can imagine the outcry that poured out as soon as this broke.
Absolutely. And it's said that the Synod delegates did hear about this on Monday. And after a few days of silence, the Holy Father has responded, as well as the Synod, although many say it's not enough. What did the statement released from the Vatican say, and what else was said?
So today the Vatican did release a statement. Pope Francis asked the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith to, quote, review the case and decided to lift the statute of limitations to allow a trial to take place. So this means there will now officially be an investigation into these these allegations. And one possible outcome of this investigation is that Father Ropnik could be laicized. Now, the Holy See's statement that was released today also said that the church must learn from the synod that is, again, in its final days here, to listen attentively and compassionately, which you mentioned this letter to the people of God that came out to the faithful earlier this week. In that very letter, similar language was used there because the synod participants said in a letter to the faithful, to listen to victims of abuse.
And that's significant, and I know that our entire EWTN News team will be watching that story. Let's go back to the synod. A few minutes ago, we heard Archbishop Rolio, head of the USCCB, talk about the importance of listening during the synod, which is enriched by the diversity of voices from around the world. That was also something that struck Bishop Robert Barron, who talked to Vatican correspondent Colin Flynn. Let's take a listen to that.
We tend to see the world through the rather myopic lenses of the West. And you realize very quickly it's very different in other parts of the world. And issues that preoccupy us in the Western world often do not preoccupy people in other parts of the world at all. In fact, on the contrary. And that, I think, has been one of the interesting dynamics of the synod.
Catherine, in your reporting at the synod, does that diversity of cultures also bring a diversity of priorities? Or has there been unity in what is being discussed for this final report?
There's definitely been that diversity of thought, and I've heard from, you know, multiple people, it's really been beautiful to see the universal church be brought together in this way. But I spoke with one source who is a voting delegate, and this source made the point that because a lot of these discussions are actually timed, there's time limits to them, they're limited in their ability to really tussle and debate and really have profound debate over issues that are more sensitive and more delicate. And so this source of mine was saying, they really wished there was just a little bit more opportunity to fully grapple with this. At the same time, I've heard over and over again in various conversations that the fact that the synod is bringing people together who have various viewpoints, who might be totally ideologically opposed and otherwise would not choose to sit next to each other, are being invited to sit down with each other at this table. And could this be, in fact, a remedy to the polarization that we are marked by during these times and these echo chambers that we all find ourselves in? The fact that you are sitting next to someone who you otherwise would not have spoken to, that is something that has been a fruit, I would say, that we've heard of.
Definitely something worth noting. What you mentioned about these hot button issues, there is a lot of back and forth on the issue of women. And one of the synod participants, Renee Kohler Ryan, had this to say.
I think that the more we associate the priesthood with power that is understood in purely secular terms, the more we're feeding clericalism. And it seems that at least some of the women who are advocating for female priesthood see the priest as the one with the most authority in a local community, and so that's what they want, that authority. So I think that it does in some way feed into this problem of clericalism.
Pope Francis has also stressed that clericalism is bad. What are you hearing about how the synod might respond to the question of ordaining women?
Well, Kohler Ryan was definitely very vocal against these calls for the ordination of women. This is really important. There was some big news that broke just this week while we were here in Rome. A new book, an Italian interview book with Pope Francis, was released this week. It was actually released in Spanish over the summer. But in it, Pope Francis is very clear that holy orders is reserved for men. He has once again said, you know, this conversation about the ordination of women, that is closed. That door is closed. It's not going to happen. Also this week at a press conference for the Synod, Cardinal Prevost, who's with the Dicastery for Bishops, he said that clericalizing women does not solve a problem. In fact, it could create more problems, which is, again, a significant thing to hear from a high-up synod delegate in these final days of the synod. But again, we know these discussions have been happening. There have been some tense discussions over this topic in the synod halls, but this is key. Just because something is being discussed does not mean that's what's being decided.
That's interesting. Well, should the faithful then be expecting any surprises in the summary document released this weekend? And when will it actually be released, Catherine?
Well, they will be voting on Saturday, and it's going to be expected to be released quite late on Saturday. We now know they are going to be voting paragraph by paragraph through this very thorough document, which, again, synthesizes all of the discussions that have been had over this month. So that's going to be a huge undertaking. We're expecting it late on Saturday, and then we will know. But something I want to stress for anyone who might have some anxiety over what could be included in this synthesis document, this is an interim document. There is still one full year of the Senate to take place, in which they will then put together their final document to go to Pope Francis. So that is just keep that context in mind. And when those news reports start coming out this weekend with the conclusion of the first General Assembly of the Synod.
And the reminder from Archbishop Rolio to get involved, laity. So thank you so much, Catherine. We'll leave it right there.
Thanks, Monte.
The Synod on Synodality ends with a closing mass this weekend, which EWTN will air live. You can get complete wrap-up analysis online at our sister publications, the Catholic News Agency and the National Catholic Register. You can also watch Colin Flynn's entire interview with Bishop Robert Barron on the EWTN YouTube page. News headlines, including a new Speaker of the House, next in the Week in Review.
I'm Eric Rosales in Des Moines, Iowa, where I sat down with South Carolina Senator and presidential candidate Tim Scott to discuss the issues important to Catholics.
Plus, covering the presidential election, EWTN News continues our series of interviews with the candidates hoping to become our next commander-in-chief.
Even though they weren't living with us on this earth, there was respect for their lives.
And later, recognizing grief after miscarriage, we'll tell you about a special ministry designed to help families in their pain.
Topping the Week in Review, a new speaker mans the gavel in the House of Representatives. The election ends weeks of chaos and inaction in the chamber as it tried to fill the vacancy left by ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana took the gavel on Wednesday. Now that a speaker has taken the reins, the House can race against the clock and pass essential spending bills before a potential government shutdown in November. In his first address to the chamber, Johnson said the House will make up for lost time.
We want our allies around the world to know that this body of lawmakers is reporting again to our duty stations. Let the enemies of freedom around the world hear us loud and clear. The People's House is back in business.
Top priorities include sending aid to Ukraine and Israel. In his first act as Speaker, Johnson passed a resolution that condemns Hamas and declares solidarity with Israel. But the resolution is only symbolic and does not include funding for the American ally. At the White House, President Biden hosted a state dinner for Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. More than 300 guests, from politicians and government officials to celebrities, attended the lavish event to celebrate Australia's relationship with the U.S. The Prime Minister remarked that Australia has no greater friend than the United States. President Biden left the state dinner early when he was pulled out to be informed about and monitor developments in the Maine mass shooting. We continue to monitor what is happening on the presidential campaign trail. This week, EWTN News spoke to Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, about his vision for America. As of this week, he is not among the GOP candidates who have qualified for the next presidential primary debate, to be held November 8th in Miami, Florida. His national polling numbers remain stuck in the low single digits. But Scott says he believes his faith-based message will resonate with voters in the first-in-the-nation Iowa caucus. EWTN Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales spoke to Senator Scott as he campaigned in Des Moines.
Let's get to the two wars taking place right now. We have Israel versus Hamas and Ukraine versus Russia.
Yes.
The president has asked for more money from Congress. What do you see are the priorities for this as president of the United States?
If I were president, the one thing I would say is that the immediate beginning of the war that Israel is going to have to wage against Hamas to wipe them off the map, we should have our single-minded approach in funding Israel and giving them the resources, replenishing the supplies that are necessary for them to be successful. We have engaged for the last 2 years in support for Ukraine. I think separating the issue so that we can give a bipartisan, hopefully unanimous support for the state of Israel. If we can do that, that will be in America's best interest, and it will show no daylight standing shoulder to shoulder and back to back with the nation of Israel.
Let's get to the issues. Issue of abortion. You supported, co-sponsored the 15-week abortion ban. Even Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, says that's a good start.
Yes.
Do you see any sort of compromise with this, or what's your policy on abortion?
Well, I have 100%, thankfully, pro-life voting record. I'm 100% pro-life conservative. As president of the United States, I would sign very conservative pro-life legislation, and that's why we start with the 15-week limit across the nation. Creating the culture of life is how we win and are successful in saving more lives.
Another issue that you're very strong on is school choice.
Yes.
School choice, we've seen an increase in enrollment in Catholic schools after COVID,
yes.
Even during COVID. Do you see this as a broader issue that needs to be taken by the states, or is there a federal mandate that you can come up with?
Wherever the kid goes, the money follows. There's no question that a quality education is really important. And frankly, as a result of COVID, we saw kids trapped and out of the classroom, but in Catholic schools, by and large, they were still in the schools. And the precipitous drop, the largest drop in test scores in American history came because of COVID. But the Catholic schools saw their numbers stay steady or even improve. That drastic contrast, it is alive for every American to see, and we want more quality education. And I can't think of a better example of that right now in America than Catholic schools.
DACA is another big issue taking place right now. Thousands of kids are here. They want to become U.S. citizens. Even the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops calls for immigration reform. Is that something that would be part of your presidency?
You know, I look in the past and I see the coalitions have come together, even under the former president, President Trump, put a deal together for Congress where you had DACA, border protection, and unfortunately it fell apart because without first dealing with the southern border crisis, it's really hard for us to get to step two and deal with any other issues. And so my position would be the same, that the most compassionate thing we can do immediately is to eliminate the threat coming from our southern border. That opens up the conversation for us to talk about a meritocracy in this nation as it relates to a border and as it relates to an immigration policy.
Let's talk a little bit about racism. It's still alive out there in America. You are a conservative Southern man, but also a conservative Southern black man.
Yes.
You are a mentor. You are someone of people of color to look up to as a leader. Do you see the presidency still having that hurdle for the African American or for a person of color?
Well, I think in this nation, you can be anything you want to be, to include to be president of the United States. We've seen it happen in the past. The good news is I have great confidence in the voters of our country to choose a candidate that best represents their character, not the color of their skin. My goal as a presidential candidate is to make sure enough American voters get to hear and see and even feel my message. When that happens, will be their choice. So getting there is our objective. But I have no doubt in my mind that the American people will support the best candidate with the character that reflects theirs as long as we get in front of them.
Talk to me a little bit about how your faith has shaped your political decisions.
You know, in 2013, I came up with something called the Opportunity Agenda. And the Opportunity Agenda really is my faith is embedded in my Opportunity Agenda. I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one, I believe that Matthew 25 tells us a lot about the cohorts of Americans who need specific and unique attention, whether it be widowers or people who are incarcerated who need our attention. The fact of the matter is the gospel always leads us in the right direction of providing assistance. It says, when did I see you hungry and feed you? When did I see you thirsty and give you something to drink? When did I see you naked and clothe you? As you've done unto the least of these, so you do it unto me. I think we have an opportunity, not just a responsibility, but an opportunity to live out that message.
The campaign trail can be very tough. How do you keep your spiritual glass filled?
Well, you know, the only way to do it is to start every single day off in the Word of God. Every day I have the opportunity, and when I wake up, the first thing I do is pray. The second thing I do is open the book of Proverbs and read the Proverbs of the day. And then the third thing I do is a devotional. And I listen to some positive, praiseworthy music. And then I get into my news of the day and the job. But if I ever, and sometimes I have in the past, get confused and start with the politics of the day, it kind of ruins your day. And so for me, the more I search out the gospel, the better off I am the entire day. But you can't let yesterday's gospel work for today. You need it every single day.
Senator Scott, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Eric's full interview with Senator Scott will be available on the EWTN YouTube page. Plus, we have additional reporting in our sister publication, the National Catholic Register. Stay with EWTN News as we continue coverage of the 2024 presidential election, candidate interviews, debates, polling, and analysis from a Catholic perspective. Up next on EWTN News In Depth, lending comfort and God's grace to those mourning the loss of a baby. One family's journey when we return.
There is a place that they can have their baby buried, honor the life, no matter how short that life was.
Families devastated by miscarriage loss are comforted by a ministry dedicated to honoring their pain and the life of children gone too soon. The Holy Innocents Ministry in Baltimore, Maryland, is renowned for recognizing the need to grieve those who were never even born. As a couple and often siblings rejoice in the knowledge a new baby is coming, the news that the baby is gone can be crushing. October is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month. As we focus on that, Rizal Regis tells us about the unique miscarriage ministry in this Catholic Life report.
Together we have five kids. So the oldest is Jack, he's 17. And then we have Kaylin, she is 13. And Patrick is 7, Maggie is 5, and Liam is 3.
Sean and Katie Gilligan share five children together. And in 2021, they were excited to announce that they were expecting another baby.
Well, we might as well just tell everyone, and everyone was ecstatic about it and happy. Yeah.
A couple of weeks later, during a routine appointment, she was told that the baby measured smaller than expected.
I just knew, like, there was not a reason for that. I knew my dates weren't off, and so we went back for a follow-up ultrasound, and there was no heartbeat that time.
Sean and Katie were devastated. After having four perfectly healthy pregnancies and babies, Katie could not believe this was happening.
That was when Sean started Googling support for Catholic families that are experiencing miscarriages. Mm-hmm. I found this ministry. It's called Holy Innocents. It's through the Archdiocese, and they'll bury our baby.
Holy Innocents is a burial ministry in the Archdiocese of Baltimore for families who have lost their children to miscarriage, whether at home or in a hospital. Through Holy Innocents, the Gilligan family was able to bury Jude Joseph in October 2021.
The little casket with all the babies in it. Prayer cards with your baby's name on it, and flowers and holy water, and just the whole ceremony. And it really, for me, it kind of brought me that sense of peace where I may not have ever met my baby, but to be able to know that, like, we gave our baby this burial, and it was very special to our babies with all these other perfect little babies. And for me, that made me feel really good, actually.
This is one edge of the area.
Father Patrick Carrion is the founder of Holy Innocents Ministry. After attending a burial for miscarried children at a Catholic hospital, he thought to himself, why not have a ministry like this one in the Archdiocese, especially for those families who experience a miscarriage at home?
25% of pregnancies end in a miscarriage. I mean, that is a tremendous amount, percentage. Obviously, many of them are probably in that first trimester, but to many families, it didn't matter whether it was the first week or the 38th week, you know, they lost their child.
The Holy Innocents Ministry held its first burial in 2018. Since then, the ministry has provided families with
healing, comfort, you know, and we don't have need to be silent about it, being very public about it. And I think even having, you know, whatever, 10, 12 families there together, they're like, oh, okay, I'm not alone.
In October 2022, Katie found out she was pregnant again, but she was cautiously excited.
When, you know, we found out we were pregnant, I kind of had this weird, feeling. I mean, you've been through it before, you kind of know. And I kind of said, you know what? I sat there one day and I just, out loud, I was driving, and I said, you know what, God? I said, if this is what you want, if you want this baby too, I might not totally understand it, but I'm going to be okay with it.
At 17 weeks pregnant, she was informed that their baby girl, who they named Anna Catherine, no longer had a heartbeat. This miscarriage hit their family hard. For Sean and Katie, leaning into the Holy Innocents Ministry helped bring their families closer to their faith.
One of the things they sent just for the kids, which was awesome, is a book about explaining the loss to the children, which is awesome because, you know, our kids will talk all the time about, well, I'm going to go pray and I'm going to go, you know, ask Saint whoever to go check up on baby Jude or baby Anna.
Their 7-year-old son Patrick was the most affected by the loss.
And that's why we told Patrick, especially because he asked us why, and we told him, we're like, it was a gift from God for us to even have them for that short period of time and to know about them.
So they remind the children that their siblings are in heaven with the most perfect family.
The babies are with Jesus, the babies are with Mary. Mary was like the most perfect, she is the most perfect mother. And now that's who's taking care of our babies. Like, they're really blessed.
Hi, baby Jude. Love you.
Katie said losing their children is the hardest thing their family has ever had to deal with. But working with the Holy Innocents Ministry and being surrounded by a strong faith community made a huge impact in their lives. Katie and Father Carrion want to reach other women and families who have experienced a miscarriage in hopes of helping them grieve and heal.
I've always been very open to talk about my losses in the first place because I think oftentimes women really feel alone. They feel so isolated when they're going through this, and it's really hard.
I have found, you know, just even starting this ministry, it's I'd be hard-pressed to find a conversation where if I mentioned this ministry and someone did not share a personal story. I'm hoping that because we have this public ministry, that it gives people the chance, you know, you can talk about a miscarriage.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
If you or someone you know could benefit from this unique ministry, go to the website of the Archdiocese of Baltimore at www.archbalt.org. Under the Ministry tab, go to Miscarriage Ministry to find out more. Up next, creative ways to reuse vacant or underused church property. The University of Notre Dame leading the way. That report when we return. As Catholic parishes, convents, and seminaries across the United States and the world consolidate or repurpose buildings, a lot of property is standing empty or falling out of use. Many organizations are involved in trying to figure out the best way to use that property for the greater good, including the Church Properties Initiative at the University of Notre Dame. And this week, in conjunction with its fall conference, the initiative is sponsoring a contest for the most resourceful and creative way to repurpose church properties. Here are images from some of the 130 people who submitted contest ideas from 5 continents. The projects range from a Catholic Rural Life Service Center in the farmland of Wisconsin, to affordable housing units in the old school building in New Jersey, to Catholic student housing at a public university in Missouri. To select a winner, judges are looking at projects' financial sustainability, inclusiveness, and impact. In addition to innovative use of church property, the submissions are required to project a bold vision that is distinctly Catholic. Though the winner will not be announced until Monday, we do know the five finalists and are joined now by one of them. Marty Arlinghouse is the president and CEO of the Serenelli Project, a prison ministry in Cincinnati, Ohio. The project his group entered in the Notre Dame competition is the planned purchase and renovation of an old Catholic church, Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Cincinnati. Formerly incarcerated men will work alongside the professionals making repairs so that they can learn a trade and the dignity of work. Once refurbished, the Serenelli Project will use the church as a spiritual home for those who have served their time and are re-entering the community. Sometimes those returning citizens are uncomfortable joining a more traditional Catholic parish. Marty, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on being a finalist in this competition. Much of the Serenelli Project's work is done inside prisons, directly with those not yet released back into community. Can you give us a sense of what your ministry provides inside those walls?
Sure, yeah. The main thing is to provide the sacraments. I take care of three prisons, and my main job is to make sure that I regularly get priests signed up. Either first I have to get them approved in the prison and then signed up on a regular schedule to come provide Mass, confession. If I don't have a priest 1 week, then we have to provide a communion service. And on top of that, though, we provide RCIA and other just Catholic programs to try to create not only education for the inmates, but Catholic community for them so that they really feel like they have a community to belong to in the Catholic faith.
And what inspired you to do this, this life within the walls, Catholic life within the walls?
It started with a priest who came to my parish when I was in college. I was a music major, and I wasn't a vocal major, but I could sing a little bit. He heard me singing really loudly, and he said, "Hey, the inmates could really use some help singing in the Mass. Do you want to come sing with them?" And I said, "Okay, sure." So I went with him one weekend, and I loved it so much that I kept going as a volunteer. And then in 2019, my predecessor in my role as director of prison ministry called me up and said, "Hey, I'm going to pass this on. I was thinking about you. Would you want to take it over?" So I was thrilled that she thought of me, and it was kind of a dream come true in terms of ministry.
And a beautiful call. Well, tell us more about the Our Lady of Perpetual Help project and what you're trying to accomplish there. Why did you use this as your award entry?
Well, it started with a guy asking if he could become a priest in the prison. And I thought, well, this guy's going to need something more like a monastery for him when he gets out of prison. And a monastery needs a chapel. And I've been seeing Our Lady of Perpetual Help, a couple of other churches around Cincinnati that have been abandoned. And I thought, it's a shame that those are just dilapidating and not doing anything. Maybe we can buy one of them and have that become the monastery for these guys coming out of prison. So that's how we ended up with Our Lady of Perpetual Help, and a 3-year process now of trying to buy it and get started on this community.
Now, that's just part of helping the overall neighborhood, one piece, the neighborhood environment. We have a video of a nearby house the Serenelli Project renovated into a chapel. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so while we've been waiting for the church, we purchased our first house because we do want to have multiple houses in the neighborhood for the men to live in, and then the chapel becomes their conventional chapel. But in this first house, we took one of the rooms and we turned it into the Chapel of St. Maria Goretti. That was a very fun and for good first endeavor for us to create a chapel. And the Archbishop came and blessed it in June of this year. We've had some masses. We've had other prayer services. We do the First Friday devotion there. And it's serving as kind of the first little seed of this community to start growing this.
Now, this project that you submitted, Our Lady of Perpetual Help, it hopes to create a monastic community for repentant former prisoners. What are you looking for in these men? They have to be accepted into this program first, right?
Right. Yeah, we're looking for someone who at least has some kind of a strong desire for Catholic community and contemplative life. They might not be called to be a monk. They might be going somewhere else later on in life, but at least their desire is to have a community where they really are praying and working together. They're going to do recovery services. Most of the people we work with do have some kind of drug addiction in their history. and just overall really having a strong community to be a part of, to surround them with, but also for them to truly want to be a part of a community. Oftentimes with criminality, you have a lot of isolation, and we're trying to create connection instead so that they have a much better chance, not only of not recidivating, but that they can truly become a fruitful member of the church. Now, we hope in that there might be a few who really are called to a religious life, that, like this guy asked if he could become a priest, that we're creating a community where these guys can discern that and maybe one day profess vows and perhaps even become ordained.
Now, really quick, Marty, you're creating community for them. Do you have strong community and support from your bishop?
Yeah, he's been very, very supportive. I mean, he came and blessed our chapel, so that says quite a bit. And the Archbishop has always been very supportive of the prison ministry. He always enjoys when he comes into the prisons. And we've kept him in the loop the whole time as we've been developing this. And he basically has just given us the green light to say, go pursue your mission and make it as best as you can be.
Well, we'll say the same to you, and good luck with the competition this weekend.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll reveal the winner of the Church Property Initiatives competition at Notre Dame. All the projects, whether an award winner or not, bringing positive changes to their communities. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again, same time next week, as we bring you news important to your Catholic life. See you then.